Today's lecture is on natural selection. So natural selection can be viewed from very much a microorganismal perspective, and a lot of that, the difference between what goes on among microorganisms and what goes on among other types of organisms that one typically will be studying natural selection association with, is the clonal nature of microorganisms. So here we have one person's perspective on how evolution works. And I like it because it goes from very much a molecular perspective to a macroevolutionary perspective. So it runs the gamut. It's not necessarily perfect in between, but it's a good place to start. So basically, you've got genetic material here, DNA. In most cases, it's DNA. DNA can be modified in terms of sequence by mutations. In fact, mutations are defined as changes in the sequence of nucleic acids. This results, by definition, in a change in the genotype of an organism. And changes in genotype can give rise to changes in phenotype. Changes in genotype and phenotype underlie variety within populations. And this variety, this genetic variety, particularly as it modifies phenotype, can be described in terms of adaptations. And then you have the subjecting of these populations displaying this variation to their ecology, to the ecology that's associated with the environment. That is the interactions the organisms have with their environment. And when that occurs, suddenly you've got natural selection entering into the process. Natural selection basically is a biased reproductive success of some alleles over others, and the result is a modification in the frequency of alleles within populations. This is the process of adaptation. It is increasing the fitness of an organism to its environment. And then you can go onward. If you, after multiple rounds of an ongoing natural selection, you have a building up of adaptations, an ongoing modification of organisms. This may in fact result ultimately in speciation events, although more is going on when speciation occurs than simply the accumulation of adaptations. And then you can have basically differential speciation. In other words, some species give rise to more species than others species do. And also differential extinction of species. This is the realm of macroevolution down here. In here we have microevolution, a combination of mutation and selection, but also genetic drift and migration. So natural selection is acting here. This is where ecology is coming into play. And this bias, survival, and reproductive success is basically natural selection. It is a biasing in the survival and reproductive success of some alleles versus other alleles as found within the population. And then as noted, that is speciation, this formation of new species, and macroevolution is going on down here. This chapter is not really about macroevolution or speciation. Instead, it is looking specifically at this process right here of natural selection, and also it's considering the idea that natural selection very much occurs within the context of an organism's ecology. So speaking of ecology, so all natural selection is ecological. So what is ecology all about? Ecology is the interaction of organisms with their environments. We can define environments in a number of different ways, and as a consequence, we've got a number of different subdisciplines of ecology. So there is the interaction of organisms with their abiotic environment, the non-living aspects of their environment. There are interactions of organisms with the biotic or living aspects of their environment. The biotic can be differentiated into the same species versus a different species, so that's conspecifics versus other species. And we also have an organism's impact on the abiotic environment, not just the impact of the abiotic on the organism, but the impact of the organism on the abiotic environment. So starting with interactions among species, this is studied, within species. This is studied within the context of what's known as population ecology. So this is the interaction of organisms with members of their own species. Organisms can also interact with other species, another component of their biotic environment. This is studied under the guise of community ecology. organisms are impacted and adapt to the abiotic portions of their environment, components of their environment. And you can describe organismal ecology as the study of organism adaptation to the abiotic aspects of their environment, how they deal with the abiotic aspects of their environment. And in turn, organisms can impact their environment when they impact the abiotic components of environment. This is generally described as ecosystem ecology. And ecosystem ecology is used to study the movement of energy and nutrients, both cycling within ecosystems and also moving through ecosystems. So population ecology, adaptation of conspecifics to each other. A lot of soft selection in there. Community ecology, adaptation of organisms to other species. And there's a hard selection going on here. Organismal ecology, adaptation of organisms to abiotic components of their environment. Again, hard selection. And then ecosystem ecology is really not looking at the organisms themselves, but instead how the ecosystem itself is modified by organism activity. So that's ecology. So natural selection is basically what gives rise to adaptation. And it's important to recognize what adaptations are. At their simplest, an adaptation is simply a modification in genotype that has the effect of modifying fitness. And usually we think of it in terms of increasing the fitness of an organism. But that's relatively simplistic because we're talking about, in a sense, just individual alleles within the population increasing in frequency and therefore increasing the average fitness of the population. But the way evolution typically works is instead the accumulation not of a single allele, but of multiple alleles at multiple loci over time. And so what you end up with is a gradual stepwise increase in the fitness of populations as those populations fix one beneficial allele after another. And we can describe this process as cumulative adaptation. So the way natural selection operates within natural populations is by increasing the fitness of those populations or of individuals within those populations, one adaptation at a time, with the individuals that have already fixed one adaptation, already have one beneficial allele in their association, will tend to gain an additional beneficial allele, an additional beneficial allele, and so on and so forth, cumulatively, such that adaptations build up over time. So we have adaptation. It's intimately linked with selection, but also is linked with this idea of cumulative. You have to keep in mind that all adaptations ultimately start out as mutations. Mutations are what creates these new alleles, or alternatively, they can come into a population via migration. It's not selection that creates these new alleles, but it is natural selection that assures that you have multiple beneficial alleles found within the same individual. Whether it's sexual processes that are bringing mutations together, or instead just a cumulative accumulation of mutations within a single lineage by mutation alone. So natural selection, what it does is it increases the likelihood that adaptive mutations are going to be found in the same individual. So mutations, they put this variation, genetic variation, into populations, but that really doesn't do anything for the population in terms of its increasing its fitness. Natural selection has the effect of increasing the fitness of a population, but it also has the effect of biasing the survival of those mutations that are beneficial, and the result of this biased survival, this increase in the frequency of beneficial mutations, is that you're going to have a higher likelihood that more than one beneficial mutation is going to be found in the same individual. This is a kind of simplistic way of thinking about the world, in the sense that it is, in a sense, obvious that natural selection should build up the number of beneficial mutations and types of beneficial mutations in populations. But nevertheless, it's crucial to kind of deconstruct that whole idea and walk through it step by step to truly gain a good intuitive understanding of what's going on. So adaptations, they're basically, when an organism adapts to its environment, it basically is increasing the fit, in a literal sense, between a phenotype and its environment. This is a fit in terms of the ability of the organism to survive. The organisms that better fit their environments, that interact with their environments in a sense better, have a greater potential to survive within those environments. And also individuals that fit their environments better, that are doing things more in a sense in harmony with what's going on in their environments, rather than being crushed and taken down by their environment, also have a greater potential to produce progeny, therefore greater reproductive success. So fitness can literally be thought of as a increase, as a measure of the fit between a phenotype and its environment. How well associated in terms of its characteristics phenotype is with the environment in which that phenotype is contained. And these increases in fitness can be described as adaptation, and adaptations generally can be described as phenotypes as viewed in terms of how they fit their environment. Some may fit their environment better. These would be beneficial alleles, or are underlain by beneficial alleles. Some may fit their environments worse, lead to lower potential to survive and reproduce. And these would be basically detrimental alleles that underlie those phenotypes. So what natural selection does is it serves to edit out of populations those that variation, genetic variation within a population that's less adaptive. So basically those individuals that fit their environment, whose phenotypes fit their environment less well, tend to be removed from populations via natural selection. And you therefore have a trend towards an increase in the fitness of the populations to their environment, an increase in the degree to which phenotypes fit their environments within populations. And that is called adaptation. And that is the main product of natural selection. Variation that contributes to greater reproductive success in the face of natural selection thus tends to be retained within populations. So mutation puts variation in, and natural selection takes variation out. And specifically, the variation that's taken out by natural selection is that variation that results in phenotypes that are less fit to environments. And in turn, fitness is a measure of reproductive success, and thus ultimately the fit of an organism's phenotype into its environment can be measured in terms of the potential for that phenotype to in fact reproduce. So the underlying alleles associated with the phenotype, they have a Darwinian fitness, as it's called, that is measurable in terms of the reproductive success of those associated with those alleles. So the idea of cumulative adaptation, the cumulative building up of an organism's fit to its environment, the generation of phenotypes that allow the organism to be more reproductively successful, this is an illustration of that idea. So if you have an individual, and that individual is able to reproduce, it's going to have a number of progeny. It's actually easier to think about these things in terms of clonal organisms, which again is going to be our emphasis here. So we've got a building up of this population. In fact, within this population, there may be an accumulation of mutations. Some of those mutations may have an impact on the phenotype of the individual, and in turn, an impact on the fitness of the individual. Now, within this population, you're going to have all of these individuals potentially increasing in representation of their genotypes within the environment. In other words, you might have an expansion of each of these individuals, only showing one here. But any of the alleles that are found in this individual are going to be part of this expansion. And in the course of the expansion of its population size, you again are going to have mutations. And then you could have an expansion of each of these individuals. And within that expansion, you're going to have mutations and so on and so forth. So if this individual here had a mutation that allowed it to increase its representation within a population, then all of those individuals down here presumably are going to possess the same beneficial allele. If this individual had another mutation that allowed it to have an increase in its frequency within the population, then those individuals, in a sense, will now have two beneficial alleles, and all of their progeny will as well. And then you have a further exploration of sequence space. That individual may have yet an additional mutation that's beneficial, causing it to increase its frequency in the population. And now you have individuals down all through here that in fact have three beneficial alleles in association. And among those, again, there'll be mutation events. And here we have yet another individual that has a beneficial allele causing its population to increase in frequency within the larger population, its numbers. And these individuals, in fact, now have four beneficial alleles. So one, two, three, and then four beneficial alleles. So there's this expansion of the population. You have a beneficial allele, it causes an increase in the frequency of those individuals that possess that allele. And within that now expanded population, you have a higher likelihood that there are going to be mutations, simply because there are more of those individuals. And some of those mutations are going to be beneficial. And those beneficial mutations are going to lead to further expansion of the population. And thus you have an expansion that has multiple beneficial alleles, and because it itself is becoming larger in size, you have the potential for the accumulation of yet additional mutations and additional beneficial alleles and additional alleles and additional expansion of the population. Again, this idea is easier to see within clonal populations because you don't have mutations coming from different lineages that then get together in the same individuals. But instead, you have a single genotype. It's going through time, mutating as it goes, and the genotypes that tend to possess beneficial alleles will increase in frequency, and therefore it's specifically those genotypes with beneficial alleles that are more likely to accumulate additional mutations, among which will be beneficial alleles. It's not quite that simple, however, because there's something called clonal interference that can get in the way of all of this, as well as periodic selection, which can have the effect of driving to extinction alleles that, in fact, are beneficial in clonal populations. But as a start, as a default way of looking at things, natural selection works to increase the adaptation, the fitness, the fit of an organism to its environment, cumulatively via the accumulation over time within the same lineage, within the same genome, of multiple beneficial alleles. So this is an expansion of the population. That could be selection of a mutant, further expansion of the population of this mutant, and then selection for the double mutant or triple mutant if we're starting out with a beneficial mutation here, and then expansion of that mutation of that mutant, and then accumulation of further mutations and expansion, and so on and so on and so on, so that there is a tendency for beneficial alleles to end up in those organisms, those individuals that in fact already have beneficial alleles, simply because organisms that have beneficial alleles, that carry beneficial alleles, will tend to be more represented within a population, tend to have a greater representation within a population, and therefore simply due to numbers alone have a greater potential to harbor new mutations, among which can be beneficial mutations. Then there's the idea of evolutionary ecology. So we can break things up into evolutionary biology on one hand, ecology on the other hand, and really somewhere in between is evolutionary ecology. And together these three things are basically the foundations of population biology, and part of what this course is all about is a consideration of microbial population biology. So evolutionary ecology, what is it? So basically evolutionary ecology is the evolutionary study of adaptation. It is the consideration of the why of adaptation. It's consideration of why some adaptations tend to have survived within populations, whereas others have not. Now, in many cases, why certain adaptations have come to the fore is relatively trivial if it allows an org if a mutation allows an organism to utilize a new carbon source that's abundant in its environment. Obviously, that mutation is going to be adaptively beneficial. However, some of these adaptations, it's subtle. It's difficult to understand exactly why that adaptation has increased in frequency within the population. One of the things that I've studied over the years is lysis timing in bacteriophages, how long they stay inside of cells before they break open those cells to release their progeny. The longer they stay inside of the cells, the more progeny they make. However, the faster they break open their cells, the sooner they break open their cells, the faster those progeny can find new cells to infect. There's a trade-off between these two things because the progeny can't get out of the cells that they're accumulating within without destroying the infection itself, without destroying the ability of these cells to make new progeny. And so the question is, why would they have one lysis timing versus another? Shorter times until lysis versus longer times until lysis? And the answer to that question is not 100% obvious. I've made the argument that the reason that you have a certain lysis timing versus another is a function of how many new bacteria there are in the world outside of a cell for these released bacteriophages to find and infect. If you don't have many bacteria out there, then it pays to stay inside of a cell longer and make more progeny. Stick with the bacterium you have when it's uncertain whether you'll find the new bacterium. And when there are lots of bacteria out there, it pays to make fewer progeny and release your progeny sooner. But these are the kinds of questions that one can ask in a evolutionary ecological context. And again, the interesting questions are the ones that are more difficult to answer. So what exactly is evolutionary ecology? So this is one definition. Ecology is the study of plants and animals and microorganisms at home, that is to say in their natural environment, from the Greek word oikos, or house. Evolutionary ecology is the branch of this subject that considers how organisms have evolved to become adapted to their environment, including in this term, their interactions with members of their own and other species, the biotic environment, as well as the physical environment or the abiotic environment. It examines the selective pressure imposed by the environment and the evolutionary response to these pressures. Darwin, in 1859, proposed natural selection as a unifying principle to explain two things: the transmutation of species, that is how species become new species, and the adaptation of organisms to their environment. Evolutionary ecology takes the second of these as its field of study. It aims to explain, in light of current knowledge, how the innumerable species inhabiting the world have been modified so as to acquire the perfection of structure and coadaptation that most justly excites our admiration. In other words, evolutionary ecology is all about the why of adaptation. Why do certain organisms have the adaptations that they have? We can consider the evolutionary ecology of organisms such as bacteriophages, which I show here mainly because I have the figure that I published a few years back. Again, I like to start out with the molecular and end up with the ecology at different ends of spectra. So molecular are the familiar biochemistry, physiology, genetics. These things all underlie how an organism functions. The way an organism functions can be looked at organismal levels of consideration. And so with bacteriophages, you have various what can be described as life history characteristics. That is, for example, how effectively they find and acquire new bacteria, their adsorption, what their infection characteristics are like. For example, how long they stay within a cell, their lysis timing determines that. And how many progeny organisms, how many progeny bacteriophages they produce during these infections. So all of these have relatively complex molecular underpinnings, but it's these organismal characteristics that represent the means by which an organism interacts with its environment, that is, what its ecology consists of. Ecological interactions include such things as population ecology, community ecology, ecosystem, organismal ecology. Now, the ecology itself, it feeds back upon the molecular. It does so through the filter of phenotype, these organismal properties. It also does so in terms of mutation. And so between natural selection and mutation, you have modification of genetics, which in turn modifies biochemistry, which in turn modifies physiology, which in turn modifies organismal characteristics, which in turn modifies ecological interactions. In addition, you have phenotypic plasticity, which basically is the response, molecular response of an organism to environmental changes. So this is not a genetic response, but instead a physiological response. So this arrow here represents selection or natural selection, and this arrow here represents phenotypic plasticity. So you've got molecular aspects that give rise to what an organism basically is all about and how it functions. That functioning occurs within an ecological context, which is represents an organism's interaction with its environment, and that ecological context feeds back upon the molecular and ultimately the organismal and ultimately the ecological, both in terms of natural selection as well as mutation on the one hand, and in terms of modifying the phenotype in a non-genetic manner, in a phenotypic plasticity sense on the other hand. And ultimately, adaptations represent how the organism fits with its environment, which is an ecological aspect of the organism. Next, we can consider basically the tie between natural selection and fitness. So natural selection basically gives rise to a differential reproductive success among different individuals that differ basically in their genetics in terms of what alleles they carry. In terms of phenotype, you could say in terms of differences in their adaptations that they possess. And fitness refers to basically this differential reproductive success. The greater the potential for reproductive success, the greater the fitness of an organism. And essentially, natural selection differentiates among different genotypes in terms of potential for reproductive success. And again, fitness is a measure of that reproductive success. Differential survival is important as well, but differential survival is not what ultimately is key. It's reproductive success that's the true measure of fitness. Differential survival is important only to the extent that it in fact impacts the reproductive success of an organism. You can't reproduce if you don't survive. All else being equal, one genotype is more likely to survive until reproductive maturation than some other less fit genotype. It is particularly those genotypes that have the greatest potential to survive to the point of reproduction and then actually successfully reproduce that would be considered to be the more fit individuals within an environment. And natural selection is simply the biased reproductive success of those individuals that display a greater potential to reproduce successfully. It's not quite a tautology. It's simply saying that some organisms have a greater potential to reproduce and successfully, and those organisms that reproduce more successfully will simply come to dominate the population. That process we call natural selection. The process itself is not a tautology. We just simply have a name for the process, and that process is natural selection. We also describe those individuals that display greater reproductive success as being more fit, and natural selection increases the frequency of those individuals that are more fit within a population. Again, it's not a tautology. It's simply a name that we've given to a process. The process is very much real. It's biased reproductive success. Some organisms are better able to reproduce than others. We call those organisms that are better able to reproduce than others fitter, displaying a greater Darwinian fitness. And we describe natural selection. We cite the process. We call the process natural selection, the process by which those individuals that display a greater fit to their environment tend to increase their proportion within their environment simply as a consequence of greater reproductive success. So differential reproductive success is what natural selection is all about. Differential reproductive success means that one genotype is capable of producing more progeny than another less fit genotype. Again, this is not circular reasoning. There is a real process out there. It is a biased reproductive success. It is a statistical thing. There is a lack of independence between an organism's phenotype and its ability to reproduce. Some phenotypes are going to have greater potential to reproduce. There's also a lack of independence between organisms' phenotype and their genotypes. Some phenotypes are going to be underlain by genotypes that, in fact, bestow upon the organisms they're a part of a greater potential to reproduce. And if you don't have genetic drift mucking up the works, you will expect those organisms that have a greater potential to reproduce to, in fact, increase their frequency within the population. And we call this process natural selection. This is not, in terms of reproductive success, it's not just producing more progeny. I mean, it can be, in some cases, relatively trivial to produce more progeny. What's key is not just the number of progeny that are produced, but also the number of progeny that survive to also reproduce. So making lots and lots and lots and lots of cheap progeny is not necessarily going to be the most effective way to increase the representation of an allele within a population. Key is the production of a maximal number of progeny that they themselves are capable of reproducing. So reproductive success is more than just making babies. It's raising those babies, sending them off to college, having them get married, and having children of their own, to put it in human terms. The concept of Darwinian fitness, it's basically the same as fitness. When you say fitness, what you mean is Darwinian fitness. And again, fitness is simply a measure of reproductive success, although there's more than one way to measure reproductive success. And there are lots of different surrogates that you can use for fitness, such as the ability to survive. Those individuals, all else being held constant, that have a lower ability to survive will display a lower fitness versus those individuals that display a greater ability to survive. So when you get down to the nitty-gritty of actually determining fitness, it's not necessarily a straightforward or easy process. On the other hand, when you say fitness, what you basically mean is Darwinian fitness, and when you say Darwinian fitness, what you basically mean is fitness. They're pretty much synonymous terms. We can differentiate fitness into absolute fitness versus relative fitness. So when you're talking about the actual number of progeny that an individual produces, or the number of progeny that survive to also produce progeny, that is a description of the absolute fitness of an individual or a genotype. It is simply the measure of reproductive success, of absolute reproductive success. On the other hand, often one employs relative fitness instead. In fact, often in microbial population biology and microbial experimental evolution studies, one employs relative fitness instead. And this is because it can be relatively difficult to determine the absolute number of progeny that one organism produces versus another, especially since there's a time variable in there. It's not just how many progeny you produce, but how fast they produce, as well as how successful those progeny themselves are in making progeny of their own, and so on. And so often it's easier to just measure the relative rate of change in numbers or frequency of two different lineages within a population, and simply compare those numbers and call that relative fitness. In a traditional sense, what one often does is looks at two different genotypes, typically differing in terms of only a single allele, and determining the number of the reproductive success of one lineage as a function of the other lineage. For example, we might call the more successful lineage, the lineage with a greater reproductive success, we might give it a relative fitness of one, and the other lineage might produce only three quarters as many progeny over the same period of time. And so we'll give that lineage a relative fitness of 0.75. But in microbial population biology studies, often what one sees is a competition between two different lineages. One lineage often will possess a selectively neutral marker so that the two lineages are easy to distinguish from one another. Because these lineages are not necessarily having sex, it's easy to keep them separated from one another, even if they're in the same test tube. You just grow these guys out under a certain set of conditions, and you see, you compare how many you started with how many you end up with, and the relative change basically is used as a means of estimating relative fitness of the population. So relative fitness turns out to be a very important means by which fitness is measured within populations. Although there's information that's lost in that, and that is basically the absolute number of progeny that are being successfully produced per unit time per individual possessing a given genotype. This is an experiment, a very famous experiment by Rich Lenski. It was started at UC Irvine in California, and it has been continued at Michigan State University. I had a chance to actually visit Rich at his Irvine lab very early on in this experiment, something like 1989. I was visiting California from Arizona, probably to do little more than go to the beach and hang out in Hollywood for a little while. But on the way, I knew that Rich's lab was there, and I decided to stop on by, and he told me all about this great experiment where he had these lineages of E. coli, and he was simply transferring them from test tube to test tube, day in and day out, and seeing what happened. And at the time, he was trying to understand the impact of genetic drift on these populations. And my thought at the time was boy, this was a really stupid experiment. But this turns out to be one of the most celebrated experiments in all of microbial population biology. And so all that simply tells me is that I had little imagination at the time, although who knows what I would have thought in the same circumstances today. At any rate, what Rich and his students and postdocs have done is to propagate these E. coli strains over time, and they divide and they divide and they divide and they divide and they divide. This is an early paper in a whole series of papers, and it's simply they're measuring fitness in some manner. I'm not actually sure what the manner is. It may be the rate of replication, maybe the number of bacteria that are present at the end of a day. But nevertheless, they've got some measure of fitness. And in fact, this my uncertainty here goes to another important aspect of fitness measurements, and that is that there are multiple different ways of measuring fitness, including rate of replication, including potential to survive through hard times, including the number of individuals that are produced, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's just lots of different ways. But via this measure of fitness, in fact, this is a relative fitness. You've got the fitness of the initial population that they're comparing to. This population does whatever it does in a certain way, and over time, over generations, you have an increase in the fitness of the population. And in fact, it's a fairly substantial increase. After 300 days of propagation, about 2,000 generations of E. coli, you've increased the fitness of the population by about 30%, which is impressive. But this is an increase in fitness. Presumably these E. coli at this end are better fit to their environment than the E. coli at this end. And this fitness is manifest in some aspect of reproductive success, which is described as its fitness. And here you've got that reproductive success presented in terms of the relative fitness of the population. This next slide is a grab bag that talks about a number of different processes that are relevant to natural selection. So first of all, it's considering generations, for the production of new generations, the fecundity of organisms, and also death as an important component of the fixation of alleles within populations. So in growing populations, what is important is differences in intrinsic growth rates. That is how fast organisms can increase their numbers. They can increase their numbers, of course, by producing a certain number of offspring, but it's also important how fast they produce those offspring. So you have a combination of relevance of fecundity on the one hand and generation time on the other hand, but there's more to it than that. So generation time, the shorter the generation time, the faster the progeny are produced, then the more fit the organism, all else held constant or all else not varied. Also important is the clutch size or the fecundity of the organism. So the larger the clutches, the more organisms that are produced per reproductive episode, then the more fit the organism. But this is, unless these increases in the clutch size comes at a cost in terms of, for example, the survival of the offspring or the future reproductive output of the parents. And so What we're seeing here are the ideas of trade-offs. In fact, there might be trade-offs between generation time and clutch sizes. And the organisms that are most fit are going to be the ones that best balance these various trade-offs. So optimizing an organism, increasing the fitness of the organism, it actually becomes quite complicated. Measuring the fitness of an organism becomes quite complicated. There's lots of complications associated with evolutionary biology. And a lot of them, in fact, come from evolutionary ecology, the interaction of organisms with their environments. And the idea of trade-offs goes to the heart of what evolutionary ecology is all about. Also important is death. Now death is important in a potentially in an evolutionary ecological sense. I mean, there are ways that organisms can increase their fitness, in fact, by dying, particularly if it's helpful to their offspring. But I'm talking about an importance to death that's different from the relevance to adaptation, but instead in a purely evolutionary biological sense, and death is actually highly relevant. So in a population of unlimited size, then bacteria displaying differing growth rates would coexist indefinitely. So in other words, you have the population expanding, and if the population's infinite in size, some genotype is going to be increasing in frequency within that population. Some alleles will be increasing their numbers. But if the population is infinite in size, you're never actually going to get rid of the other genotypes. Unless, of course, those other genotypes possess mutations that are fatal to them, in which case they'll kind of auto-eliminate. But as so long as the genotype can reproduce at all, if the population size is infinite, then the genotype's never going away. It's going to become a smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller fraction of the total population. But it's never going to go away because the population size is infinite. So in a population of unlimited size, then bacteria displaying differing growth rates would coexist indefinitely, although the ratios would always be changing in favor of more recent types. In a population of fixed size, however, the older types would be eliminated by sampling. So what is sampling? Remember sampling error. What is sampling error? Sampling error is genetic drift. So what we have here is a situation where you can't get rid of deleterious alleles within a population that's infinite in size. Because with a population that's infinite size, you don't have sampling error, you don't have genetic drift. So, in other words, to get rid of those genotypes that are inferior, you have to have some means by which they die off. So death suddenly becomes an important component of, in fact, adaptation. So given some form of death, then there would be a tendency towards replacement. Not just diminishment in the frequency of alleles and genotypes, but the actual replacement of alleles and phenotypes by another allele and phenotype, the fixation of alleles. It's difficult to fix alleles in an absolute sense in a population that's infinite in size because you're lacking this sampling error. But in a population that is not infinite in size, then you're going to diminish the size, the fraction of the population that in fact is the inferior genotypes or alleles, until via sampling error, those individuals simply go away. As their numbers become smaller and smaller and smaller, sampling error is going to become more and more important, and ultimately the individuals will be lost just simply as a consequence of chance. So without death, there's no mechanism to eliminate the less fit individuals from a population. So what we have here is the origin of an allele and the increase in the frequency of the allele over time. So this is the lactase production within adults, basically. And this allele, in theory, could just increase and increase and increase in frequency over time. And if the population was infinite, see, this is an asymptotic curve. It never quite makes it to what presumably is 1.0 here. Because if the population is infinite, it can constantly increase in frequency without ever actually reaching 100% of the population. But in a population that's not infinite in size, as the rest of the population, in this case the individuals that don't produce lactase as adults, are going to become smaller and smaller in number and therefore be subject to genetic drift to a greater extent until by chance, as the frequency, as the size of the subpopulation bounces up and down, the population of lactose non-persisters would go extinct. So these guys will never reach fixation in a infinite in population. And they don't reach fixation unless the carriers of the lactose non-persistence alleles literally die off. So death turns out to be very important with allele fixation. Natural selection is responsible, presumably, for the shape of this curve, this increase. I mean, that's purely natural selection. We see a curve like that, allele frequencies going up and up and up. The first thing we should be thinking is natural selection. But for that allele to actually find its way to fixation, to move out of being a part of a polymorphism or being the preponderance of alleles within a population, to actually reach fixation in an absolute sense, 100% of the population, you have to have those alleles that are other than the dominant allele within the population to die off. And they're not going to die off unless they encode a lethal phenotype, unless, of course, you have sampling error intervening. So we're talking about natural selection, and there are various ways in which natural selection is manifest and various ways that you can distinguish among natural selection. And one of these ways is in terms of hard versus soft selection. So hard selection basically is the selection that you think about when you think about selection, if you think about selection at all, which is the environment imposing some kind of hardship on a population. The population's fitness declines as a consequence, and then the population can respond through adaptation, increasing its fitness. Soft selection, by contrast, involves intra-specific competition. In the case of soft selection, basically the environmental component is one's own species, and this complicates things. But we'll start with hard selection. So hard selection involves the struggle of individuals or the struggle that individuals face to survive and reproduce in the face of environmental constraints. Typically, this will be some kind of abiotic or instead biotic component of the environment, and typically the biotic component would be some other species. It can be ongoing or it can be something that is newly imposed upon the population. It has the effect, the presence of whatever this selective force is, has the effect of reducing the average fitness of a population. So, for example, bacteria growing in the presence of an antibiotic or bacteria that are being subject to an immune system attack. Both of these things are not good for the bacterium, and as a consequence, there's a reduction in the associated fitness of the bacterium when you've imposed these things on its population. So the results of hard selection are declines in population sizes, or at least the population isn't able to attain the size that it might be capable of were this hard selection not present and not ongoing. It has the potential to drive a population to extinction. So if you have a population that's not being subject to hard selection, you impose hard selection on it, its fitness declines. Its fitness might decline to the point where the population is no longer successfully replacing itself, and eventually it will go extinct as a consequence. The response to hard selection, by contrast, actually results in an increase in the mean fitness of the population. These are adaptations in the sense that we've been considering adaptations, where essentially the individuals that have an adaptation, and in this case, an adaptation response to this hard selection, will display a greater fitness, a greater reproductive success than individuals that lack the adaptation. As these adaptations increase in frequency within the population, the average fitness of the population increases. Hard selection tends to give rise to an increase in the absolute fitness of a population, but only assuming that the relevant variation exists within the population. If that variation does not exist, then you're not going to get this adaptation. Remember, natural selection is all about favoring some alleles over other alleles, but in order for that to occur, there's got to be more than one allele present at a given locus. If more than one allele is not present at a given locus, then you're not going to have favoring of one over the other. You're not going to have natural selection. You're not going to have an increase in the fitness or the absolute fitness of a population. So soft selection. So soft selection in it, population size does not decline as a consequence of soft selection. This is because although selection is being imposed on some individuals, it's being imposed by the same by members of the same population. If a subpopulation declines in frequency and the rest of the population makes up for that decline, then you're not going to see a change in the size of the population. And this is, in a sense, the essence of soft selection. And this is why soft selection doesn't really impact absolute fitness. You have declines in individuals relative to one another in terms of their fitness. But overall, the population's fitness basically stays pretty much the same, or at least it doesn't increase. So there's an increase instead of in terms of absolute fitness, but an increase in the relative fitness of certain members of the population relative to other members of the population. So the average fitness of the population basically ideally remains at one, but some individuals may display a higher fitness relative to others, but still the average fitness remains about one. Soft selection can't drive populations to extinction, or at least it can't drive populations to extinction directly. It is possible for populations to become better and better at competing against each other, and have this occur at the expense of those populations being able to deal with environmental change, but that's in a sense a different story. And there's more, but we'll get to it. First, we're going to talk about hard selection again. So here we have hard selection being imposed by the presence of antibiotics in environments. The antibiotics reduce the fitness of the population when the antibiotics are imposed upon the population. And this reduction in fitness is seen as a reduction in the actual size of the population. This reduction in size of the population, basically the population isn't replicating as fast as they're being killed by the antibiotic or other components of the environment that are actually killing the bacteria in the presence of the antibiotic. You're going to see a decline until the point where the bacterium are extinct, have gone extinct. Unless, of course, the bacterial population contains genetic variation in terms of resistance to antibiotics that allows a portion of the population to persist. This portion of the population increases in frequency within the population, and that increase in frequency is the increase in the average fitness of the population. So the population has some fitness. You impose the hard selection, in this case via antibiotic addition, and the fitness declines. But then the fitness of the population can recover as more and more of the population consists of individuals that are resistant to the antibiotic. It's not necessarily going to recover all the way back to where it started. Hard selection itself doesn't make the population recover. It's the response to hard selection that involves recovery of the population's fitness, average fitness. And that recovery basically involves the fixation of beneficial alleles. Alleles, in fact, that are newly beneficial within the population, ones that confer resistance to an antibiotic. So that's the imposition of hard selection actually right there with the addition of the antibiotic. So back to soft selection. Soft selection is intraspecific competition. Soft selection involves competition of individuals with their conspecifics such that one individual loses in terms of mortality or reproductive output relative to another individual in the population. Soft selection, it's competition between conspecifics. So in a pure culture of bacteria that's limited by limiting nutrient, it's those individuals that are more effectively converting the nutrient into new individuals that will be the better competitors. But this isn't necessarily going to increase the fitness in the absolute terms of these individuals. They might become faster growers, but they're not necessarily going to become more fit in other terms. Competitive exclusion is something that you see that's basically all about competition between individuals, although not necessarily with conspecifics. The consequence of soft selection is greater competitive ability specifically against conspecifics. So it's specifically adaptation to the presence of individuals within one's environment that are one's own species. But there's no necessarily increase in the mean or average fitness of the population as a consequence of responding to soft selection. Individuals, for example, may be faster in their growth rate, but they may be no more efficient in their utilization of resources. And as we'll get to, it is quite possible for individuals to be quite better at competing against their conspecifics and at the same time be pretty pathetic in terms of their absolute fitness. So improvement in competitive ability actually can result in declines in the average fitness of the population rather than increases. The environment that's being fit better in the case of soft selection is a biotic environment, and specifically it's one that consists of conspecifics. You take away these conspecifics, and the population is no better off because it's specifically in terms of competing with members of the same species that is being selected for here. Now, having said that, it's also possible to become more competitive for reasons that are more akin to responding to hard selection. So, for example, if you become more competitive because you're able to utilize a carbon source that's available that that can't be utilized by other members of your population, of course you're going to increase in fitness, but that's not soft selection that you're responding to. It is increasing your competitive ability by simply increasing the average fitness of a population that consists of your genotype. It's just that in terms of competition, these scenarios where an individual becomes a better competitor by fitting to aspects of the environment that are other than conspecific, that's simply not the only way to become a better competitor. It's also possible to become a better competitor by being better, more effective at competing with members of your own population. And we're actually going to get to ideas of soft selection, specifically when we talk about the evolution of cooperation. With the evolution of cooperation, it's possible to defect and to gain because of those defection behaviors, but that defection actually doesn't result in an increase in the average fitness of the population, and in fact, in the absence of cooperators, the defectors can be quite badly off, with their average fitness actually declining as the sole members of the population rather than increasing, even as their competitive ability increases. So as an illustration of at least competition between different populations or different individuals, what we have here is in fact an inter-specific competition, a competition that occurs between two different species. And this is within the guise of what's known as competitive exclusion. So what you have up top here are individuals that are competing, or actually are not directly competing because they're in fact in different test tubes or different flasks. And they're able to attain certain levels of population sizes at an equilibrium or steady state. But when you put the two populations together, in fact, one of the populations is able to drive the other population essentially to extinction. Now, this driving to extinction occurs because this population here, the red population, is able to utilize nutrients and convert those nutrients into more organisms more effectively during the competition than the blue organisms are. Now, typically, this decline here would actually be seen further up in the curve. It's when the population is nearing its steady state that the nutrients, the limiting nutrients that both are competing for, decline in amount sufficiently because they're being used up by the individuals making up the populations, that it is those individuals that are able to compete at essentially lower nutrient densities that will win this competition. So this is a lot like what you see with intra-specific competition, where a population becomes sufficiently large that the amount of resources available to the population is no longer as great, and therefore the population stops growing as much and in fact enters into a steady state that it's its carrying capacity. And that really is what's going on here. But as you increase the population size towards carrying capacity, the number of resources in the population declines because they're being used up, and they're no longer available to the less competitive individuals. These two individuals are competing over the same nutrients or other resources, and as those resources become scarce, the red individuals simply are more effective at maintaining their population size and are growing than these individuals are. We're going to see these ideas more explicitly in a subsequent chapter. So competitive exclusion, that's what's going on here. When the two populations are in the same culture, one of the populations is being driven to extinction by the other population. This typically will occur nearer to carrying capacity than this figure actually shows. This is soft selection to the extent that these individuals are not suffering from additional mortality. They're just not able to compete in the same environment as effectively as these other individuals. And so they're simply not able to replicate as fast once nutrients become limiting. And because of the way the culture is propagated, they're not able to keep up with the dilution of the culture, and therefore they decline and go extinct. Nevertheless, with this soft selection, if indeed we can think of this in terms of intraspecific competition, note that these red individuals, that their population size actually doesn't really increase relative to where it was when these individuals are just growing alone. In fact, the way they've shown it, it's actually decreased, although that might just be a mistake on the part of the artist. So this is very much soft selection. These individuals are not adapting necessarily to their environments. They're simply doing what they're doing, and they're better at what they're doing. And all they really are good at, in a fitness sense, is outcompeting these individuals versus improving their abilities to grow in the absence of those individuals.